You're listening to EAA Radio. I'm Afterburner Al. This is the Aviation Journalist Roundtable. Mac McClellan, editor of Flying Magazine, is here. Mike Sullivan, a reporter with the Atlantic Flyer. Pat Panzera, editor of Contact Magazine. Tom Haynes, editor of AOPA Magazine. And David Hipschman, who's the editor of Sport Aviation, who also has a big decal collection you'd like to tell us about.
I may have to get AOPA's Phil Boyer to give some money to my good friend Tom to send me, because I keep talking about the decals in my car. I'm both an AOPA member and an AAA member, obviously.
And we appreciate that.
I think every pilot should be a member of both organizations. I think both organizations do phenomenal work for their members. The Airport Watch program that Tom mentioned earlier is a great, great program with an 800 number you can call. But since we're all journalists, I think there's something that needs to be said about mainstream journalists and community. This whole business about terrorism and small airplanes is baloney. And the media, the mainstream media, needs to be taken to task in their individual communities for inflaming what is essentially an argument that is not an argument. I think it behooves every single pilot to go down to their local newspaper and invite a reporter to take a flight and explain to them who they are, that we are not the enemy. You've seen that t-shirt. We are not the enemy. We are actually, if you parse citizenship by aircraft aviation involvement, the history of this nation has the blood of aviators all over it who've defended this country. Many of those people are still flying out of small airports all around the nation. If you take a reporter for an airplane flight, if you talk to your local newspaper editor about how you feel about the baloney that they're putting in the newspapers about small airplanes being some threat, I think you would do yourself and the aviation community and your community at home a great service.
One of the things that I lead Chapter 22 in Rockford, Illinois, and one thing that we did, we thought the way that to keep our chapter revitalized is to go after the general public and use the sport pilot rule as our tool, and we held a light sport aircraft fly-in in early June, and we invited the general public. We bought radio advertising, and we got the word out as best we can. Luckily, the big air festival with the Blue Angels was the week before. It got moved up so they could get on the Blue Angels schedule. So we went out to that air show, and the airport gave us space there for us to shake hands, grip and grin for 3 days, and they let us fly in a couple powered trikes to sit out there. So we had a little bit of stroke of luck in promoting this, but the next week we had 102 aircraft, light sport aircraft flying, including about 10 to 12 vendors, and they flew their light sports, Technam and Icarus and Eurofox were some of them that showed up, plus power. We had every category of light sport except, I think it was, I can't remember which one, but we had the balloon, we had the glider, we had just about everything there. But we also had 350, 400 people from the community. And we had them fill out information, are they interested in learning how to fly and so on. And at And what are some of the other ways that light sport and sport pilot rule might impact the way that the new pilots are being trained and recruited?
Well, I think that Cessna's announcement here this week represents the greatest hope of the EAA when they spent the 10 years developing this rule. We've all believed that we're going to attract people to aviation if they can learn to fly in a less complicated way in a new and exciting airplane, modern avionics, glass cockpit. And I think Cessna's new 162 offers all of those things. And they will be able to package it to where a certificate is approximately half the price of learning under the current rules in an old airplane. So this is going to be exciting to watch. It's still a year and a half away. But I think this is the core of the light sport hope. The replicas, the classics, some of us maybe at some point in our life being able to fly without a medical, those are nice benefits. But the really important part is attracting more people to aviation.
Absolutely. In addition to Cessna, Cirrus' offering, which was unveiled yesterday, I guess it was, of their light sport, which is a German light sport aircraft that's being manufactured for Cirrus. The thing that's astonishing to me, having had the great pleasure of visiting both with Cessna's Jack Pelton and the Klapmeyer brothers from Cirrus, when they get done talking about, the obvious question is the price. Why does it have to cost so much? There's product liability issues, there's production issues, there's manufacturing costs. And they have their stockholders in black ink to think about. But the thread in the conversations with all three of them was about dreaming, which was an astonishing thing for me, that these CEOs of these aircraft companies come to it out of their own personal experiences as dreamers. And as Max says, this is about lowering the barrier so that more people can get involved in education. One of the things the EAA is doing currently on the grounds at AirVenture, there's a Learn to Fly Center in cooperation with the National Association of Flight Instructors. We've just published a brand new sort of magazine-style booklet called Reach for the Sky, which is specifically to answer the questions of brand new people who are interested in aviation. I remember when I learned to fly how scared I was the first time I walked up to an FBO. There was all these people there who sort of belonged and knew what they were doing and knew where to go, and I was this kid that was walking up and I was like all nervous whether anybody was going to accept me or talk to me. And in addition to this, the LSAs and the sport pilot movement, I think it keeps coming back to community, which Mr. Sullivan keeps bringing to the table in this discussion, is that we have to remember to be welcoming. We have to remember to, any chance you get, welcome some new participant into what we love.
I want to extend your point, David, just a little bit further. I think that we need to cast our net to a much wider audience.
Absolutely.
We're selling LSA pilot licenses and the LSA community, the mall here, wonderful exhibition, there's regional exhibitions. We're talking to ourselves. We need to get out to the non-flyer. We need to get the advertising not into flying magazines. This is not heresy. We need to get the advertising and the allure and the excitement and the passion of flying out into the general media magazines. Look at the way we sell cars.
You're absolutely right.
Look at the way the marine community sells recreational boating.
Right.
They put those ads out in every conceivable magazine.
Right.
And I don't know what the return rate is. Maybe it's 0.1%. But we're not casting our net wide enough.
I'm so happy to hear you say this, because I don't want to bang the EAA drum, because this is really about all of us. As I've been saying to Tom from the AOPA, in the Learn to Fly Center here, there's a brand new student pilot kit that you can pick up here. And inside that kit, there's a electronic sign-on that will enable you, come September 1st, to subscribe for free to a brand new email newsletter about learning to fly that's open to the world. I mean, people can get involved via the EAA's website offerings and new email properties to turn their... I had a member come up to me the other day, and he said, and I was telling him about this, and it blew me away, because he said, I got to give you my grandson's email address so you can tell him about this. You're right.
And the important thing when you're welcoming people into that community, though, is that you have a good product for them, because people coming in today are much more sophisticated than they used to be.
AOPA's flight training is great at that.
Well, thank you for that, too.
Yeah.
But all of us who've been around aviation for a long time might get all misty-eyed over a 1940-something Champ or an Aircoup. At the end of the day, people coming in today are expecting a much more sophisticated product, and that's what is really wonderful about what's coming to the market now between Cessna and Cirrus and also some of the European models with glass cockpits and very comfortable, given the size of the airplane, and pretty good performance, and all of that is something that will be much more appealing to people just testing the waters with general aviation than what might otherwise be available, which is the much older airplanes, which many of them will, once they get a certificate, may well find very interesting and challenging and fun to go fly a Champ, but it probably isn't the place that the way that they ought to be introduced to general aviation.
But the reality with that is that we have this fleet already in place in flight centers that are virtually gathering cobwebs as we speak, and we have people who desperately want to fly LSA and don't have aircraft to fly in. I think the whole LSA rules just missed the mark when they added an arbitrary weight limit that took the Tomahawk, the Beach Skipper, the 150, the 152, even the 140 out of the loop that are currently in our FBOs today. Granted, they're older aircraft, but you know what? They're really inexpensive to operate. You take, for example, our local FBO, who doesn't have a huge budget to work with. They've got a Tomahawk and a Warrior, and they're barely making ends meet. They don't have $150,000 to spend on a couple of planes in order to meet this demand that isn't there yet, because they don't have the equipment. Let me finish here for just one second. I personally have a very remarkable young man working in my booth right now for me. He's 24 years old. He desperately wants to fly. He's a cancer survivor. His possibility of ever getting a medical is nil. He wants to fly so bad you wouldn't believe it. He has an opportunity to go get his license, but then come home to nothing to fly. I, on the other hand, I'm this close to having LSA CFI, but I don't have an aircraft to build those 10 hours that I need that seem to be, again, arbitrary, nor do I have an aircraft to take a check ride in. So it's kind of the cart before the horse. If we were allowed to use these planes that we already have in existence, this thing would be launched like crazy already.
First of all, I guess I agree with you in the main, but I think I have to point out that whenever governmental bureaucracy is involved, a line has to be drawn somewhere. Had the line been driven at a heavier weight to include the 150, let's say, then people would be saying, well, what about my Cherokee? I mean, so looking backwards, although it's fun, and I agree with you that life would be better had the line been drawn somewhere else, the line was drawn, and the line is what it is. We have to live with that.
Of getting an exemption for those specific aircraft?
There's a 800 number I could give you to call EAA's Aviation Services.
There
you can talk to Charlie Becker or Joe Norris, and they'll be able to help you with that. I'm not an expert on that, but I do want to say this. You know, Cessna's new Skycatcher is a year and a half away. Cirrus's new airplane in terms of certification in the United States is, I don't know, probably a year away. Yeah. But you look around, there's lots of LSA out there that come from outside of the United States. Some of them come from inside the United States that are brand new airplanes that are affordable. So I think it's a bit disingenuous to say that they're, certainly it's not the size of the 150 fleet, but there's airplanes out there, and maybe you got to drive a little further. But the amazing thing about dreaming is that dreaming has desire attached to it. And if you got the desire, a person can find a way to do it. All of us sitting here at this table found a way to learn how to fly back when we weren't making the kind of money that Mac and Tom are making today. Forgive me, but we all found a way to do it, and people will find a way to do it. I mean,
well,
it's about dreams.
You look at, for example, that a $18,000 Tomahawk costs $56 an hour for the FBO to rent out. What's it going to cost them for an $80,000 or $100,000 LSA? They're going to have to charge $120, $130 an hour to rent that thing.
Well, what is the flexibility that was built into the sport pilot rule? Was there any flexibility to allow other expansion of the category and to adjust? There has been some talk, at least so I've read it in the popular press, about some other airplanes being ushered in. Does anyone know if there's flexibility in this?
No, there's very little. And of course, it is a new rule, and it was designed to create new airplanes or new aircraft, a whole range of things. We tend to get focused on the light airplane, the top end, the 1,320 pound end, but this rule goes all the way back to a powered parachute, right, a weight shift hang glider. So it's a huge rule, and the lines had to be drawn somewhere, and many post-war airplanes missed it by a few pounds, 100 pounds, 200 pounds, and perhaps it was an accident, but more likely it was an intent to drive the industry into a new airplane with new technology, new construction materials. And nothing will be as cheap as a 50-year-old worn-out airplane.
Are you saying the rule is not perfect like tax law is?
Well, you know, for some reason we've changed everything at 12,500 pounds for almost 50 years now. and we've changed everything when it's a turbojet instead of a turboprop. And so the rules are arbitrary, and the lines are drawn somewhere.
But go back a minute to what you guys were saying earlier about getting new participants involved. You know, when you think about a young person just starting out their career, getting a good job, making money, they're in their late 20s, and they go and they buy a new car, and they're making a payment. And it's probably a car that I couldn't afford to buy today. It was kind of interesting to me to hear Jack Pelton say something, or maybe it was one of their marketing people, say something about, you know, if a person gets out of their Lexus when they get out at the FBO, they don't want to go get into a 40-year-old Cherokee or a 40-year-old 152. But if you're talking about the new participants with disposal, you know, Max right in terms of the lower weight stuff. But if you're talking about a $100,000 airplane and buying one, I mean, who's buying Cirruses? There's young people out there buying brand new Cirruses. They're selling them.
They're not entry level.
Well, but they've got an entry level one now.
Actually, no, surprising number of them are entry level.
Extremely, yes. So very low experience.
Yeah. Right.
The history has been.
Listen to some of them on the frequency.
That's right. The history is new pilots buy new airplanes. We old farts tend to take this attitude.
Glad you said that.
Yes, okay. You know what, 10, 15, 20-year-old airplane is as good. It can be updated. We have all these rationalizations. People new to aviation don't think that way. They don't buy used cars. They don't buy used other equipment.
You're right.
And so they buy the new airplane. And so whether it's a Cirrus, a Cessna, a Mooney, the best candidate for those new airplanes is someone new to the activity who intends to use it purposefully. The hobbyist is a different...
Exactly.
And the industry can't survive on hobbyists. The FBO network, the manufacturers, the parts supply network, they require purposeful use of an airplane of any size, whatever it might be, a single piston or jet. And so we have to attract those people. And then the hobbyist is beneficiary of this system. The excess capacity that's put in for the on-purpose transportation use flows down and allows the hobbyist to have fuel, to have maintenance, to have parts, to have a runway, to have lights on the runway, all those kinds of things.
Well, the new pilot might buy a new plane, but the new student doesn't, and that's what we're talking about, is getting the community more involved. And I could go out tomorrow, preach LSA to our community, and have 10 people lined up wanting to fly, but we got nothing for them to fly.
Yeah, but I think if 10 people showed up wanting to fly, someone would get it together and find a way to provide service. I mean, that's capitalism.
Yes,
There's people teaching entry-level sport pilot in Piper Cubs today. They're cropping up all over the place. So it's a lot of our grandparents and people just a little bit older than me, like Mac, have learned in those kinds of
absolutely.
Airplanes.
Absolutely, Cessna 140.
So there you go. So,
yeah, I mean,
where's that Piper Cub on the flight line? I personally had to drive 150 miles to get my tail dragger endorsement because no one's got a tail dragger.
Where do you live?
I live in the Central Valley, California.
Well,
at Frederick, which is a very busy flight school with brand new Cessnas all over the place, they went out and found an air coupe and put it on the line, and they're using it for light sport training. And it's very popular. And my guess is they'll probably end up with one of these new airplanes from one of the mainstream manufacturers once they become available.
One of the discussions that we had at the airport where I'm based at least the small fun airport that I'm based at called Cottonwood Airport, is that it's a grass strip, it's a private public use, and there is no FBO there, yet we wanted to have flight instruction or at least something available, and we talked about different ways that we could get a group of people together. Is it a flying club? Is it we get somebody who bites the bullet and makes it available? How do you grow together or create these opportunities that we just discussed to make it affordable for people to come off the street and rent this? It's been a good discussion, and we're going to take one more break.
Build one.
Yes, we can always build one. We're going to come back and talk about one more issue, and that is how to go green. You're listening to EAA Radio.